I went to an HBCU my first year of college, and then my second year, I went to a predominantly white school, and I would walk down the street, and I would feel like, oh man, there's not a lot of people outside. And I would see a couple people. But then, I don't know, I think I had a diversity class or something, or I started to have more white friends, and I would go outside and I'm like, whoa, there are hundreds of people out here. Why didn't I see those people before?
Marquita grew up in Detroit. You may know that her city lost a huge chunk of its population in the 50s and 60s as the auto industry moved out of the city center. And since that time, it's become the archetypical Rust Belt city, marked by urban decay and vacant spaces. If that's all you know, if that's the limits of your perspective, then you need to know a little bit more about Detroit. First, you should know that one of the reasons automotive plants moved out of Detroit initially was for fear of the growing power of labor unions. Global competition in the automotive industry and the replacement of workers by automation also contributed. And second, like most cities in the US, white flight played a huge role in the city's demise. Well-off white folks feared for their, quote, safety and property values when neighborhoods and schools began integrating in the 50s and 60s. And now, if you look at a map of population density in Detroit, it's sort of donut-shaped, with low population density in the center and the surrounding suburbs much more populated. A map of average household income would show that same donut shape, with the poorest left in the center in the city of Detroit and surrounded by the middle-class suburbs. As we've talked about in previous episodes, whenever school populations dip, there are massive financial ramifications for school budgets. With the exiting students goes their allotted per pupil funding. I'm Nathaniel Bozarth, and this is Wide Ruled, BrainRoot's podcast on the past and present of equality in education. A shout out to our patrons at Patreon who help make Wide Ruled happen. You too can support Wide Ruled by visiting patreon.com/wideruledpodcast. And you can donate as little as a buck per episode we churn out. Every bit helps. This episode was made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, that's AFT, one of the largest national teachers' unions. The opinions and viewpoints espoused by today's guests are their own. AFT had no editorial say regarding the content of this episode at any point. We'll hear more from Marquita in a bit, the gal you heard at the beginning of today's episode, but first, I want you to hear from Lakia Wilson. She's school counselor at Spain Elementary and Middle School in Detroit. I talked to her at the annual AFT Teach Conference. Lakia gives more context to the world Marquita inhabited.
Around 15 to 20 years ago, the state took over Detroit Public Schools, and then began an onslaught of superintendents and CEOs, emergency managers. When we were taken over by the state, there was a $93 million surplus. And the district kind of got its hand slapped because it was monies that should have been used to update buildings. And that was the premise that the state used to take over the district. When they took it over, we haven't been in a surplus since, until this year. But I don't really consider that a surplus because the state, so to speak, gave the school district back to us. and gave us a little money. So we have $64 million this year surplus. However, the $93 million has never been explained. We've requested an audit. So again, we have a huge decline in terms of enrollment, in terms of finances for the district over the past 15 to 20 years, thanks to the state.
So to recap that for you, even if that $90 million surplus was problematic in the beginning, and it was problematic, what's odd is that after the government takeover, things got worse, not better. There are a host of reasons for the continually deteriorating conditions, and frankly, it's one of the saddest stories I've ever heard in my life. Besides Lakia, I talked to three other teachers from the Detroit Public Schools Community District. All of them had taught 20 years or more, and as they told me the story of their schools, I was overwhelmed by how heroic was their long-suffering and devotion to their students. Shout out to Lakia Wilson, Glenda Booker, Alina Brantley Phillips, and Robin Jennings. They are heroes. But rather than reproducing my conversation with those ladies here, I wanted to focus in on Marquita. Now, she didn't go to Detroit Public Schools, but went to a charter school, Cherry Hill School of Performing Arts, while living in Detroit before moving out to the suburbs. The decay of Left Behind Detroit, that feeling that Lakia articulated of feeling betrayed by the state of Michigan, that was Marquita's world too.
I remember, man, it was rough in academics. Like, I remember a couple of classes only because they were so different. Like, we had this one teacher who, he said, like, you know, I'm trying to teach you guys how to learn and how to pay attention. And so he had a test, and he gave us all a test, and he's like, you know, you need to make sure you read carefully. And we read the test, and we answered all the questions. This is social studies. We answered all the questions, and we turned it in, and he's like, everybody failed, you know, because at the bottom of the test, like the last thing on the test said, if you were reading, you would know not to write on this test, or something like that. It was so crazy. I mean, I don't think he put that on our final grade, but it was, you know, stuff like that I remember.
I feel like you got tricked.
It was, but I guess he was teaching us how to pay attention to documents. But then I remember other things like math class. I literally didn't learn anything in math. One of our teachers, I don't know if he was just burned out or what, but he was like, he would turn toward the board and just write and talk to the board, really. And so the class would be rowdy and just standing up and laughing and making jokes, and nobody paid attention.
There was a critical difference between these two teachers Marquita described. That second one, who didn't seem to give a rip.
He was white. I don't know. I think there was a difference in expectation, because what I remember of the white teachers I had at Cherry Hill, they would just kind of say, you know, you do your own thing, I'm going to do my thing, and this is, you know, you learn it or you don't. But you're here, so I mean, I guess I can give you the grade or whatever. But then our teacher who was like, you know, you need to read everything and I'm gonna fail you if you don't read, then he was a black teacher, and he was always on us, trying to get us to you know, be prepared for stuff like that. Like, mm-hmm. if we don't read a sentence that's, you know, mm-hmm. important, then in regular or documents that are important for our lives, then it could be detrimental. So I remember stuff like that and kind of being taken to a different place, whether that's learning social studies or life skills. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like there was a difference in expectation.
Each year, we amass more and more data to suggest the pervasiveness of this sort of expectation bias in the way students are treated. By and large, the conclusion remains that all kids need to be challenged by high expectations. However, Marquita feels that there is something particularly valuable about giving tough love to black kids.
You could see how loving, but how hard the black teachers were on the black students, but then the white teachers were kind of like, hands off, you learn what you learn, and this is, you know, I'm just going to give you the tools and you can take them whether you want to. Even when I worked at the daycare that I worked at. I do notice that a difference in expectation in terms of what teachers want from kids. And I think it's different because of the realities the teachers are living in. Like, you know, I know a lot of Black teachers who are like, you know, who are harder on the kids. And it's like, okay, you need to do this, you need to do that. Even as a daycare provider, I was like, no, before we can even get down and sit at the table, I'm telling this to one-year-olds, you need to clean up this room. And it sounds harsh, but, you know, a lot of the white teachers would say, oh, no, I'll do this for you, I'll do that, I'll do this. And it would be kind of disabling them, because when they start moving forward and they get out into the world, they're not going to be taken care of like that. So they have to fend for themselves. And so it's kind of like you need that hard love, which is so frustrating, that a lot of Black teachers and students, you know, they have a connection, but it's a lot of times it's a kind of a tough love connection, because if you don't give that tough love, then the world is going to be tough, but they're not going to give you any love. And so you're going to just be left out doing, you know, whatever and not being able to succeed in life.
In eighth grade, Marquita and her family moved to Southfield, a suburb of Detroit with the second largest Black population of Detroit area suburbs. They left because the neighborhood was getting increasingly dangerous. Marquita told me that the next door neighbor was sneaking an extension cord over the fence and stealing their electricity. So, for many reasons, they moved. Marquita's new school, like her former school, was majority Black.
But then when I moved on to the school in the suburbs, I got D's on everything. And it put me in this shock, because I'm like, why am I mean, I know I'm smart and I know I can learn, but why am I basically almost failing these classes? It just wasn't on my level. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was able to catch up, and I was able to, you know, figure things out for myself. If somebody else were there and they didn't have the same level of retention, or if they're not driven on themselves, then it would be hard to recover from that. And in that school district, it was like, you know, seventh grade, you get your grades, and then the teachers recommend what classes you get for the eighth grade. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I went to the eighth grade, and since I did kind of poorly, I was kind of in the lower classes, so I didn't get the honors classes. And then those eighth grade classes, they determine what classes you're going to be in the ninth grade. And then the ninth grade, I was like, okay, well, you know, I really want to be in some honors classes, but I didn't get any. And so the next grade, I finally got an honors class. And then the next one, I finally got an AP class. And then my senior year, I finally got like three AP classes and honors class. And, you know, so I was able to reach that because of, you know, how hard my mom wanted me to work, and how I value education. But for a lot of people, they were just stuck in that cycle because of how well you had to do at such a young age. And I mean, of course, you can make some changes, but if you don't have that support at home, or if you don't have that support, or if the teachers don't feel like you can do it, then they're not going to put you in that class.
Marquita had a teacher like that, who didn't feel she would be able to compete in his advanced science class. Marquita worked hard to convince him that she did, in fact, belong in the class. After weeks of relentless coercing and even writing an essay about why she had what it would take to succeed, he finally enrolled her, and she did succeed. What Marquita experienced in Southfield was a drastic difference in expectation from Cherry Hill School of Performing Arts, a charter school serving Detroit students. She said Cherry Hill gave everyone a false sense of accomplishment without ever giving anyone the opportunity to fail. She said it was a really good experience to actually try out for something and not be selected. But not everything in Southfield was perfect.
When I was in ninth grade and 10th grade, we had a history teacher who was white, and he's like, yeah, slavery wasn't even that bad, guys. And, you know, everybody's up in this uproar, and I'm like, what is wrong with you? Of course it was bad, because I've learned it from other Black people as well, but I wasn't so offended. And it actually made me question myself and my history, because I'm like, you must know better. I mean, you're a history teacher. You have authority as a white man. So why are you, you know, so, and my friend, of course, she's aware. She's fully aware. She's Hispanic, half black, and she's been to white schools, black schools, Hispanic schools. And so she has seen all of this stuff. And so she's like fuming when he's saying that. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of dumb that he said that. But in my mind, I'm like, yeah, that's not what I learned. But why is what I learned different from what he's telling me? He did make me question, like, well, what would it be like, you know, back then to be in that position? And maybe it's not that bad. Maybe they did have homes, like slaves did have places to live. And, you know, I mean, and mind you, I'm a kid at this point, so I don't know. But as I'm like, even as I'm talking about it now, I'm thinking about the absurdity, like, what on earth, somebody being somebody else's property, how's that not bad? Just that fact, how is that not bad?
Teachers have power. Even a white teacher over a full classroom of black students trying to tell them slavery was no big deal. On to college. Marquita first headed to Howard University, an HBCU, that's historically black college or university. And after a year, she transferred to Central Michigan State University, a majority white college.
First, I went to the black school, and everybody was so passionate about these things, and I was like, okay, you know, it's life. Yeah, we're black. Okay. You know, for me, it was so normal. Like, right. That's life. Of course we're black. A lot of people I know had connected with the world around them and saw how they were treated, and they became passionate about these things. And so for me, I'm like, I'm not so passionate because I've only spent, you know, time around people who were like me. And you know, your in-group is always more diverse than the out-group. And so when I got to Howard, we there were so many different people, and they were passionate about all these different things. But when I went to the white school, I was like, wow, this feels deserted. Like, I don't see anybody outside. And then I don't know when it hit me, but one day after like some diversity training, I was just like, wow, like, there are people out here. There are hundreds of people out here, and people are actually bumping into me. And why didn't I see them before? I mean, it sounds so crazy, but man, it was just this realization that there are other people, and they are a part of my world, you know? And mind you, I've had like white friends before, but they were within my context. Mm-hmm. You know, there were majority black people, and they were the minorities of the group. But when I started to interact, I saw the racism, I saw the microaggression, all of that. And it was just so shocking to me. Like, I mean, it's you know, as a kid, I'm like, it's not possible for me to be discriminated against. Why would somebody discriminate against me? Because I'm good at this, and we have the same credentials. So, you know, it's not possible. And sometimes I feel ashamed, you know, as a black person to talk about when I, you know, I'm in high school as like ninth grade, and I'm like, racism, how is that even a thing? I mean, I sounded so ignorant, you know? People who interact with the majority of society or who are aware, they're able to see these things, but I wasn't able to see it because I didn't see the whole. Mm-hmm. I just saw my group. And so that's probably why it was so hard for me to understand microaggression and racism and all these different things, because I'm like, you guys are my people, this is my world, this is my neighborhood, and the white people are in their own world. I might cross paths every now and then, but you're not part of my world.
It's amazing how our surroundings inform our perspective, how what we're accustomed to seeing shapes what we see. It reminds me of something one of my anthropology professors used to say: we see more with what's behind our eyes than with what's in front of them.
I think it was majority the white people's mindset of I don't see color. That was the core of it, I think, because in my neighborhoods, you know, we just saw people, but we were all black. Mm-hmm. So when we saw white people, we were like, oh, you know, the white folks, they're weird. You know, just like little cute things like that. But for the most part, it was like we see color and we know that we're subordinate. But we're not going to say anything about it because it's really not an issue. It's not an issue anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I think my neighborhood, the way that my neighborhoods were oppressed was that we should be equal. Mm-hmm. We are equal. And so if you experience anything that seems like it's unequal, something must be going on in your own mind. And you have to deal with that yourself.
So it wasn't like that you were directly brainwashed by white people. It was that your whole neighborhood was brainwashed systemically.
Yes, systemically brainwashed of, we don't see color, you are equal, you know, it's everything's on the same playing field, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. If you're not succeeding, it's your fault, you know. So everything was, you know, our responsibility to push forward and not experience racism or anything like that, because if we felt like we experienced racism, we must be wrong. Something must be wrong. So it was just that mindset of, I don't see color, everybody's equal. You know, you can say all day, oh, I'm not superior than any other race, but if you feel inferior, then it's been rooted for years and years, hundreds of years, then it's hard to kind of just pull that out. So it makes sense to me.
Every teacher and student comes to class with a world behind their eyes. They come with biases and prejudices, with a worldview shaped by their context. When teachers open their mouths, they bestow their world upon their students, and they may heal or they may wound. Marquita is now unraveling the internalized oppression she inherited from the history of her hometown and is helping others to do the same. She's currently in graduate school to become a licensed marriage and family therapist. I'm Nathaniel Bozarth, and this has been Wide Ruled, Brain Roots podcast on the past and present of equality in education. You can support Wide Ruled by visiting patreon.com/wideruledpodcast and pledging as little as $1 for every episode we churn out. No less helpful would be if you would share this episode with your friends and colleagues and rate us on iTunes. Wide Ruled is produced by myself along with executive producer Christopher Cook. Music by Audioblocks. Thanks for listening. Keep up the good fight.